Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast with Trent and Leighton Kling. Coming up on today's show, we'll talk shoe retail to lead off. We'll also go outdoors for Sportsman's Warehouse, and we'll talk grocery as Albertsons has pulled a significant product from one of its flagship markets. A reminder to like us and rate us however you do find us, whether that's on Spotify or iTunes or, as it's now called, Apple Podcasts, anywhere you access us. You can also check us out at Instagram, at Retail Podcast, Twitter as well, at Retail Podcast. So we begin today's show with Shoe Carnival. They released their fourth quarter earnings and update guidance for their next fiscal year. And we see that they may be among winners in shoe retail. We'll also talk about some of their initiatives going forward into calendar year 2019. Now, shoe retail is a retail segment that's gone through a lot of flux lately, punctuated, of course, by the Payless bankruptcy and liquidation. And even though many Payless stores have yet to close, we see that Shoe Carnival is gaining some benefit from the struggles of others. This was mentioned just briefly on the earnings call, but it doesn't seem to be an issue really with the shoe retail space as a whole. It just seems like some competitors are being weeded out. Shoe Carnival stands to maybe benefit most.
Yeah, I think so. And I think their footprint throughout the United States really says a lot about their brand and about their popularity overall. And even though shoe retail in a number of ways is maybe not the sexiest type of retail we talk about here on the podcast, it certainly is a relevant sector that maybe gets dismissed because a lot of shoe sales happen online, as do a number of other categories that are pretty prominent. But even though many Payless stores have yet to close, we can see that Shoe Carnival is gaining some benefit from the struggles of others, although an argument could be made that e-commerce might eat into brick-and-mortar shoe sales, as I just alluded to. Recent earnings from Foot Locker, Shoe Carnival, DSW, who recently changed their name to Designer Brands, and more suggest that people still very much like to shop for shoes in person. They like to try those shoes on, they want to get acquainted with the shoe, and they want to take it home from said brick-and-mortar store. Designer Brands, by the way, has around 7 straight quarters of positive footwear comps. Pretty impressive for that brand. But we do move on to the main story here in Shoe Carnival, and it's an interesting spot to be in shoe retail. They are, as they have a larger square footprint, sometimes up to 20,000 square feet, versus some competitors like Famous Footwear, Shoe Department, and Payless. The aforementioned Payless, of course, going by the wayside. But they are also heavily distributed geographically with 397 stores in 35 states. Honestly, they are the only retailer we've covered on the podcast to note their use of in-store neon and their investor relations page. So if you've ever been to a Shoe Carnival, that's what you're in for. They market heavily towards families with kids, attempting to make the buying experience a little bit more fun for families. I remember actually being taken there by our parents, and they became sort of a fan favorite for our family, as well as Famous Footwear for their occasional buy one, get one half off sales. But this experiential aspect of Shoe Carnival also helps to differentiate them a little bit from online competitors. As I just mentioned, it's about trying shoes on, yes, but it's also about the overall experience, something that a lot of people tend to forget about, yes, even in the shoe category. But we move on to the earnings, the numbers here. There was a lot that impressed us during this earnings call in particular, including a beat on some same-store sales and earnings per share. We'll begin with same-store sales, one of our favorite metrics when it comes to evaluating a retailer's ability to continue to draw meaningful traffic. This quarter, their fourth quarter, same-store sales were up 4.7%. Additionally, their e-commerce sales were up significantly, up double digits, in fact. The term here, the key term, meaningful traffic. Their overall traffic numbers were down just ever so slightly, but they continue to attract highly engaged customers into their stores, which we'll discuss in a moment. Specifically, they credited men's non-athletic shoes and women's boots as drivers of comp success. So while there may not be as many people coming into their stores, the ones that are liking their particular assortment with these two categories. While many focused on the earnings, which were certainly good, we were impressed by net sales versus last year's quarter, and we see that net sales were $234.7 million for this year's fourth quarter, 243.2 for last year's fourth quarter. While this sounds like it is down, it is made impressive by the fact that last year's fourth quarter included 14 weeks versus just 13 weeks this year. A lot of adjustments we see during a lot of retail companies' fourth quarter earnings reports that we're seeing now, or third quarter, depending on what fiscal quarter you're looking at. But when adjusted for the extra week, therefore, sales were a little bit higher this year, year over year, despite closing a net number of stores. 11 stores were closed versus last calendar year. Increases in e-commerce sales, like I said, and same-store sales were therefore thought to credit for solid top-line performance. And both very relevant topics here. And as for those earnings per share, like we mentioned, they managed 9 cents per diluted share versus analyst consensus expectations of just 6 cents per share. And this was against a net loss of 24 cents per share in fiscal 2017, although adjusted for various impairments that we see. And of course, those store closure costs because of exiting leases prematurely, they made around 11 cents per diluted share last year. So 2017, 2018, 2019, all very prominent here, and it really relates to how the company has been executing their strategy over the past 12 months, and we see that the beat occurred for a number of reasons, not the least of which was buying and distribution costs decreasing. Briefly, the earnings per diluted share of $2.45 for the fiscal year was actually a record for the company. So since it is their fourth quarter, we do have to look at their full fiscal year to get the big picture for Shoe Carnival.
And they're looking ahead to potentially a record-setting 2019 in their fiscal year of 2019, because as far as guidance is concerned, they did reiterate their earlier 2019 outlook. They expect earnings per share to set another company record, around $2.60 per share to $2.70 per share. They're seeking a comp sales increase also in the low single digits. And you compare that to 2018, they finished just shy of 5%. So this is something of a theme over the last few weeks, and it'll be a theme for another retailer we'll talk about in today's podcast, where not as bullish for the upcoming fiscal year in terms of those same store sales numbers increasing as they had been. And so as a result, a little bit of moderation tempered into those outlooks. Now, their earnings estimates for 2019, Shoe Carnival's do, they far outpace analyst expectations of $2.42 per share. So that was one reason why we saw the share price skyrocket after the earnings call, but they did warn that comp sales in quarter one might be negatively impacted by a calendar shift of Easter into April. It was kind of funny. If you were on this call, there were about four analysts that asked questions regarding guidance for March and April, because they're trying to stick a price target on Shoe Carnival. And they said, hey guys, we have no idea exactly the impact year over year, because they kind of bake in Easter to their figures and to where they feel like they should be at any given time. So they said, you know, hey folks, we can't talk about that necessarily. You know, they said, hey, we had a pretty good March. We were a little bit disappointed in February, but overall can't talk about where we feel like the first quarter is going to be because of that shift. And no doubt we'll see a lot of retailers talk about this, because anytime you have a meaningful shift of a holiday like this, nearly a month in the case of Easter, oftentimes it will shift it into another quarter. But financials aside, let's talk about their initiatives, because, you know, let's face it, we can talk about the stellar fourth quarter earnings and the outlooks, but more important to us are the initiatives that the company has set in place to continue to drive both sales and that meaningful traffic for the coming year. So when it comes to traffic, Shoe Carnival has a bit of an interesting approach. And Leighton mentioned the term meaningful traffic earlier. That's something they talked about a lot, not necessarily by name their meaningful traffic, but Shoe Carnival, unlike others in the space, they're very selective about who they try to draw into their stores. You know, others in the space will attempt to attract families, like Famous Footwear is a great example of this, or general shoppers en masse. Shoe Carnival is instead doubling down on their most frequent shoppers, and they're doing this through kind of a data-driven approach. For the first time, they're kind of making the foray into what you might call big data if you were throwing around buzzwords from 5 to 6 years ago. And you know, I think it's interesting, because we could easily second guess this strategy as one that may provide limited growth opportunities in the longer term. I think it's an idea that will probably pay off in the short term, because people have that discretionary income. And while people have money to spend, focusing on those that are spending money, after all, seems to be working. But, you kind of worry that they're putting all their eggs into one basket there with the main customers at their stores rather than trying to draw in additional customers into their stores, which we'll talk about in a second. They might be doing through potentially reaching out with real estate, but they did spend a significant amount of time on the call touching on their CRM, which they feel like has given them an advantage from a data standpoint, and it hasn't even been fully rolled out yet. The data actually started flowing for them more abundantly in July of last year. They relaunched their loyalty program, kind of reset some parameters, and that allowed them to cull a little bit more data from these shoppers. The program also added a gold level for their most active customers, something we see a lot in loyalty programs now with the multi-tiered approach. But their gold-level shoppers, according to CEO Cliff Sifford, not only go to stores more often, so they're coming in more often, but they spend around 20% more than non-gold members per visit. So they both come to stores more often, and they spend money more often. It's these gold-level shoppers that the company has really been focused on, not only in the fourth quarter of last year, but also in their marketing endeavors in the first quarter so far of this year. And not only have they been collecting data on these frequent customers, but looking at the numbers, it does seem as though they've been able to leverage it to their benefit. Specifically, right after they began to get this data, start to use that, put that into place for the back-to-school season, they actually saw a 6.5% same-store sales increase across the board in the back-to-school season. But the company said, hey, look, this is because of those high-value shoppers that we are specifically beginning to target and gain more data on. And additionally, they said these very customers were a big driver behind all those positive same-store sales we're talking about in this earnings call that took place around the holiday season. All that said, the company hasn't officially launched their new CRM initiative. It's been more of a trial run to this point, so some limitations to that data. But the key question going forward is going to relate really to how they can use it to draw in more customers, not just the same customers over and over, because as I mentioned, that works out well when those customers have money to spend. When those customers run out of money to spend, or you hit something like a little recession or a pullback in terms of consumer confidence, that's where you worry about not having grabbed those new customers over the last several years. And eventually, long term, we have to admit, discretionary income will not continue to grow each and every single year. In all likelihood, there's going to be a recession. There's going to be some sort of pullback there. And as a company, again, so important to just not put all your eggs into the basket of those gold level shoppers there, because it is important to continue to bring new shoppers in. And I think that's something that was interesting because it was kind of glossed over on the earnings call. They didn't talk a lot about bringing new shoppers in or increasing overall traffic. What they talked about is really honing down to those customers that spend the most money. And again, great short-term strategy, but time will tell whether it works out in the long term in terms of actually bolstering meaningful traffic numbers at the company.
Two things there to mention is, one, we always hearken back to the fact that your current customer, your most loyal customer, ends up being your most profitable long term. Second, we do actually a poor job sometimes in conveying how many different ways data can be used in an average retail environment. And you can call maybe Shoe Carnival an average retail environment as far as brick and mortar is concerned, despite all of their initiatives. However, being able to leverage data in different ways, not just thinking about new customer acquisition, which I'll touch on in a second, but keeping and retaining those current customers, identifying current trends, identifying what your customer wants aside from those trends. And those are all topics that aren't always mentioned. And again, it's partially our fault as well. But data that's coming out now, that the tools that all of these loyalty programs have, these CRM systems have now, it's just tremendous for the bottom line of these companies because they're able to better source and therefore have a higher inventory turn. So all of this equates to a happy shareholder in the end. And I think that's what a lot of people don't really realize is that data isn't just about having marketing campaigns and targeting your core customer. It's about taking care of your current customer and understanding where your specific market is going. What's interesting to us is that Sifford specifically mentioned using this new data to identify new store opportunities in markets that have been previously shunned out. And This is, of course, a function of two different things: identifying areas in which they have a lot of customers but no local store, and their ability to localize selection a little bit more, which they feel like they can make successful in different markets than previously targeted. They did say that no openings are planned for the immediate future, and they still figure on closing just a handful of stores in 2019. Management's best guess was around 10 new stores for 2020, so we're looking ahead here just a little bit. But this is good news because, contrary to what some people think, they're not going to just keep closing stores to have a negative net effect. They're going to be looking to open some stores in opportunity markets. At the same time, their work towards salvaging some underperforming stores has allowed them to only close 14 of the 35 locations they had previously tabbed for closure in 2018. So you really do have to look at those fine numbers and say, well, you know what? Closing some stores, typically that's a bad sign. Closing less than anticipated, much better overall versus your previous expectation for the shoe retailer. Finally, the obvious question asked on the call: how does Shoe Carnival stand to potentially benefit from that all-important pay less bankruptcy? Sifford actually mentioned the human standpoint, discussing the employees. We saw this as almost a hint that perhaps their own staffing might get a little bit of a boost from new employees familiar with footwear retail. I, for one, actually knew and had a friend who used to work at Payless, and he actually had good things to say about that environment. So I'm curious to see if there is any crossover and could really help as far as the sales staff is concerned. And while he noted that there is likely going to be some benefit from closures overall, Payless's price point is lower, on the lower end of Shoe Carnival's, so the benefit might be limited somewhat unless Payless customers choose to spend a little bit more by transferring their brand equity, so to speak, and really try out all of the different brands and banners that are out there. Sifford also mentioned that they have felt like the U.S. was a little bit over-retailed in reference to shop closures, JCPenney and Sears, all in the news as of late. They referenced that they felt eventually there would be maybe some shrink back at some point, and they need to be in a position in order to capitalize. Now we go to the all-important share price for the company. Their price took off right after the call, jumping from around $30.48 beforehand to $37.06 immediately afterward. However, the stock came back down somewhat after a little bit of a sell-off during a solid market Monday, currently trading around $32.55 as we record this very podcast, and around $502 million in market cap value, a modest price-to-earnings ratio of 13. That is a very modest one, which seems actually about right given their stance in the market. The back and forth we were hearing from management, some good, some maybe mediocre. And so with that, you see that they have no immediate expansion plans too. So this isn't a stock that's going to be going gangbusters anytime soon, at least in our opinion. We're not experts, but a 13 price-to-earnings ratio seems fairly reasonable for this stock.
We go from talking about Shoe Carnival stock price to a company that really doesn't have a stock price because they're still private despite numerous attempts to go public over the last few years. In an odd twist, Albertsons has pulled plated meals from one of its flagship markets. Now, you might be saying, like, why are we talking about this on a retail podcast? It's a one-off deal. It can't be that important to Albertson's plans for plated nationwide. But anytime something happens with Albertson's in the Boise market, it is worth exploring. And I think there's some things here to pull out of this story that suggest that maybe their acquisition of plated hasn't gone like they planned. And we talked actually in a recent podcast about how analysts' obsession with meal kits eroding grocery market share just a couple of years ago was overblown. We talked about that at the time. We were very critical of meal kits. A lot of people said, hey, meal kits are the future of grocery. But this news, along with other information that started to come out about meal kit companies really not having that success everyone thought they would, it really suggests that customers are veering away from the kits, especially in a retail setting. Now, just because Albertsons has pulled plated meals from its stores in Boise doesn't necessarily mean the kits are failing or don't have a future going forward, although we do think it probable that there will be further thinning of all of the brands that were out there and still are out there. But I think it may just be an issue that perhaps they don't have the runway to growth that others previously thought they might have. In other words, the meal kits might have reached their ceiling already. And what it does suggest as well is that the plated purchase, as I mentioned, hasn't really worked out the way Albertsons might have expected. $300 million and 2 years later, it's beginning to look more and more like a sunk cost for the retailer. And to this point, actually, plated co-founder and CEO Josh Hicks left the company in January of this year. Now, some of that news kind of floated underneath the radar, and part of this was because there wasn't a lot of fanfare around the departure. The reason for the departure was a bit of a mystery because Albertsons simply said that Hicks decided to leave the company and didn't elaborate to any media outlet. Usually, these type of situations are a bit more effusive with praise for the outgoing executive. These weren't. None of Albertson's quotes really did much other than thanking Hicks for his service, and Bloomberg noted that Albertson's did say they were looking forward to expanding plated after this took place, which obviously we're not seeing yet. In fact, we're seeing more of a contraction than anything. But now with this story and Albertson's pulling those products from Boise stores, it appears as though that expansion of plated is on hold. We're at the very least going through some serious growing pains. Now, this news comes from Boise Dev, who reports that plated meal kits are no longer available in the Boise market. Less than a year after they were rolled out, the initial announcement came in August of 2018, as on August 22nd, 20 Albertsons and Safeway stores across Idaho introduced the plated meals in-store for the first time. And actually, at that time, Hicks was quoted by Boise Weekly as saying the eventual rollout to retail stores was always part of Plated's business plan even prior to the acquisition from Albertsons, and that the announcement about the Idaho rollout was, in fact, and I quote, thrilling. Plated's initial concept was to rotate selection in stores every 6 weeks, and even if they carried out on that, it's obvious that they just did not pick up the traction they were looking for.
Absolutely not. And you see that Plated director of PR, Liz Marsh, said, as quoted again from the Boise Dev article that Trent talked about, that it is indeed true that plated meals are presently not in Boise stores. And this is interesting because if you look back just a couple years ago, Trent, or about a year and a half ago, plated did not have that much market share. So they have a lot of brand equity here in the United States. A lot of people have heard of the brand. A lot of companies have actually partnered with plated historically, but they only own 7% roughly. This is an approximate value of the meal kit market share. The dominating factors here, the dominating companies in the meal kit space, Blue Apron, HelloFresh, Home Chef, Sunbasket. Sunbasket, a company we don't talk often on this podcast about, but you can see why maybe they're pulling back the reins a little bit on the plated acquisition. She went on to say, and I should say again, this was Liz Marsh, director of PR from the Boise Dev article. She went on to say that the meals will be in, and I quote, select stores while we temporarily reduce the overall scope of Plated's retail distribution. The key word here is temporarily, as they leave the door open to potentially return to certain markets. The way the company appears to be spinning this is that the first rollout was more or less of a trial rollout, which definitely wasn't the way it was pitched to the public in the very beginning. In fact, Marsh said that, and again I quote, Plated has enjoyed the ability to test and learn on a large scale thanks to Albertson's store network, making it sound more like an extended trial if we go back and see those words. However, the article does not mention if they feel as though there will at one point be a successful spot for them in Albertson's stores. So this is sort of a 180 from what we thought was originally going to happen. Rather, they indicate that they are looking at innovation in order to expand within what they call Albertson's company's ecosystem. But if it's not in the stores, then where? Since they already have mail and home delivery options set up, it seems difficult to imagine another area for expansion besides perhaps brick and mortar. Again, really leaves you wondering if they're regretting this very large purchase. All of this as Albertsons opened its largest ever store in late March in Meridian, Idaho, a Boise suburb. This store carries the, and I quote, Market Street banner, a banner actually acquired when Albertsons acquired United Stores based out of Texas just a few years ago. United's Market Street stores were essentially puffed up grocery stores and were one of the first grocery sub-brands to offer full restaurants. They were also out in front with the beer and wine retail boom and had vast selections of organic products before Whole Foods gained such widespread popularity throughout the West Coast. Of interesting note to those who have listened to recent podcasts, this Albertsons store is actually located in the shell of a former Shopko, one of Shopko's larger square footage locations, in fact. They said essentially a complete rebuild was necessary. They also redid the foundation, which is pretty rare for a big box store to just completely rebuild like this. Nonetheless, they were able to utilize the land and make new this new grocery location.
And it's intriguing because when you look into this, of course, the Market Street banner has been around for a while. Layton alluded to the fact that United in Texas kind of pioneered that Market Street banner, something that Albertsons Safeway took over when they purchased that United chain. But the store in particular really reminded me more of a Kroger large format store, like a Fred Meyer or Marketplace format. And those up in the Northwest, of course, very familiar with that Fred Meyer concept that's so popular throughout Washington and the bordering states, only without all the clothes in the Fred Meyer or Marketplace format. There are actually some clothes, but most of them just with Idaho themes. Now, Albertson's spokesperson Kathy Holland told Boise Dev in a different article that she feels the store has around 3,500 to 4,000 different varieties of wine, making it potentially the largest selection of wine in Idaho. And she mentioned over 3,000 different types of cheeses. And if all this sounds familiar, many Marketplace stores under the Kroger banner or Fred Meyer locations have a similar wine selection in states that allow it. But moreover, I think the cheese selection is interesting because Kroger's partnership with Murray's seems to very much be the model for Albertsons at the large format store. And when you see pictures and you look at how they've kind of unveiled their cheese section, Albertsons has, very, very similar to how Murray's are set up in a lot of newer Kroger stores or reformatted Kroger stores. And in fact, Albertsons has kind of a partnership of their own, kind of that store-in-store concept, so to speak. But Albertsons has in this store a Nuts on Clark location, or kind of a station within the store. Nuts on Clark, for those that don't know, is a Chicago-based company, and they actually pop popcorn in the view of customers, trying to get, of course, hungry customers to perhaps splurge on that popcorn, and of course, always a hit with kids there. But anyway, to bring it all back around to plated, this new Albertsons store, this massive Albertsons store, will offer ready-to-go meals and heat-and-eat meals. Note, I didn't say meal kits there. I said ready-to-go and heat-and-eat meals. And it's a possibility that Albertsons, through all of their research here, has found that customers just want this level of convenience rather than taking raw but prepped ingredients and assembling it at home. And actually, this is something we've noticed at Kroger stores, where the home chef displays are often in less conspicuous locations than Kroger's heat and eat offering. This Albertsons store actually does some interesting things with the heat and eat offerings. They come under the banner Cadence Kitchen, where customers can actually walk up to a counter, choose a quantity of a particular product, take it home, and heat it as instructed. So depending on, let's say, how many scoopfuls they get, that'll serve a certain number of people. So very similar almost to the older style deli formats within some grocery stores there, only marketed, packaged a little bit differently. Some of the in-store restaurants, by the way, that ready-to-eat food we talk about, they include Ivers, which is a very traditional Seattle-based seafood joint there, Gyro, or Euro, depending on how you pronounce it. I've heard some people pronounce it Gyro, which certainly can't be right. But there's also a taco station there, Talon Tappan Spirits, which is a restaurant that integrates some beer and wine into their mix. And, of course, a Starbucks. What self-respecting grocery store doesn't have a Starbucks or Caribou Coffee or some other advent of that in today's day and age? But in all, we think this store format certainly has promise for Albertsons, as this Market Street sub-brand has a bit more appeal than the grocer's traditional stores. And it's funny, Layton and I exchange texts almost every single week about how their traditional stores, whether it's Albertsons, whether it's Safeway, whether it's another banner, they all kind of smell the same, and the smell isn't always pleasant. They've also developed a reputation as having a poor front-end throughput and less than stellar development in carrying newer or innovative products. I was actually reading a sports article online that suggested that there was such a thing as a Safeway from hell. And all the comments on it basically said, no, every Safeway is a Safeway from hell, or at the very least, every neighborhood has a Safeway from hell because the throughput is terrible. You wait in line forever. And honestly, there's not a proposition on the value or price front. So anything that allows Albertsons overall as a company to shed this perception is a positive. Although eventually they'll have to move it out of their Boise backyard in order to gain better momentum. And you don't know how quickly that's going to happen because, again, as we've talked about before on the podcast, they don't really have a ton of money. It's not exactly like a Kroger situation here. They don't have quite the expenditures available to them for these bold initiatives. Either way, if they do expand the concept, it very much appears as though they'll be doing so without plated in tow and more of those either ready-to-eat offerings or heat-and-eat offerings rather than the cook-at-home concepts.
Before we move on to our last story, one quick little bit about a recent experience I had at an Albertsons-owned grocery store. Their throughput is absolutely terrible. I ended up waiting over 20 minutes for a self-checkout line. The self-checkout technology is not up to par if you're looking to compare it to the likes of Target, Walmart, or maybe perhaps their biggest competitor in Kroger, where they keep advancing so many different iterations of self-checkout technology. What's more depressing is that aside from self-checkout, if I were to look over to the humans that were checking out other people, those lines were also extremely long and, shall I add, understaffed. So they have a lot of work to do in terms of building back up that loyalty and that perception that you can just get in and get out at a reasonable hour. This was, by the way, after peak hours. This is around 9 p.m. at night when not a lot of people are doing shopping, especially in the location that I was at. But still, they found a way to make it burdensome for just the average customer trying to buy a Clif Bar. We move on to our last story now with Sportsman's Warehouse as they release their latest earnings. And looking through the call, while the results for the fourth quarter were solid, there is some question about further growth for the company. The company, which we've only ever discussed in passing on the podcast, classifies themselves as a high growth company. They have a number of locations specifically in the Midwest and Mountain West, but have been bullish about backfilling some vacated real estate as of late. So we talk about retail apocalypse. They are trying to take advantage of a lot of that vacant space. Founded in 1986 in Midvale, Utah, their stores range from around 20,000 square feet upwards of 50,000 square feet, averaging around 39,000. So more towards the upper end of that range is your average store here for Sportsman's Warehouse. As far as merchandise selection, consider them a less flashy and smaller square foot Cabela's, Gander Mountain, or Bass Pro. From our recent visits, it seems as though they are far more focused on the merchandising and selection first and foremost. Hunting, fishing, outdoor themes, they seem to dominate what they have there on the sales floor. They don't often have the pretense of being a destination or an event, as the retailer like Bass Pro does, where a lot of people come from around a metropolitan area to come visit those stores and see what huge displays they have of a raft or of hunting gear. But their price points are generally lower than a retailer like REI. So they pretty much fit in the middle of a number of different retailers, which really does make them have sort of a niche in this arena because they can be a little bit more flexible. They have the benefit of brand while also having more of a selection than general merchandise retailers who do these segments and more flexibility, as I mentioned, real estate-wise than Bass Pro and Cabela's. As of this year, they have 93 stores in 23 states, so pretty spread out like the other retailer we mentioned here at the beginning of our podcast. But this is enough to give them the honor of having, as they call it, the largest outdoor specialty store base in the Western U.S. So a couple of different caveats there, but we switch gears and head right into the numbers here with earnings. We begin with their same-store sales yet again for this theme of the podcast here where we're talking about same-store sales first, which in our opinion were robust enough to impress even the retailers. You look through some of the guidance here and some of the remarks surrounding these earnings. They enjoyed a fourth quarter same-store sales increase of 3.1% year over year. They include e-commerce sales in this number, so an important caveat here, although they were clear that both brick and mortar and e-commerce sales were up. So if you split them up individually, they were up. It wasn't just all digital helping up that number. Contributing to the increase, again, both of those really impressed CEO John Barker, as he credited their investment in omnichannel as a big reason for the increase. On both fronts, they are increasingly moving towards buy online, pick up in store. So we say both fronts. Guess what? People coming in to get the product or to pick up the product that they spent money on to get online, they're also going to be shopping around. Maybe something catches their eye thanks to that nifty merchandising that they've been putting money into. So I think this is really a win-win for this retailer. Unlike some retailers that may have not been doing such a good job at trying to identify more purchasing habits after the buy online pickup in store transaction has happened. Think of maybe a Pier 1. To this point, they've struggled translating their in-store selection to e-commerce. However, their relaunch of their website in December finally linked up inventory across stores, distribution centers, and dropship vendors, something other businesses have had for quite some time now. Because of this, it isn't outside the realm of possibility to expect digital sales from them to increase by double digits going forward, particularly in 2020.
Now, net sales did decrease slightly, but it was entirely a function of an extra week in last year's fourth quarter. Excluding that extra week from a year ago, sales increased 4.4%, driven largely by that same-store sales increase Leighton referenced, but also by a handful of new stores over a year ago. Specifically, they added 5 new stores, or 3.9% more square footage to their overall offerings. Now, as far as that all-important earnings per share number, they came in at 25 cents per share unadjusted. They didn't adjust for anything in this year's fourth quarter. They met expectations from Zach's consensus estimates of 25 cents. Also, it was a slight improvement over last year's adjusted 20 cents per share. But as pleasant as their key metrics were in the fourth quarter, their outlook for fiscal 2019 was less than rosy, and a big reason why the stock plummeted, which we'll talk about at the end of the story. In the first quarter, they expect same-store sales to absolutely plummet to a decline of 2 to 5% in 2019. Now, this is in line with some of the worst retailers out there currently, so not a good sign to say the least. Plus, we should remember that they essentially have 2 months in the books for the first quarter. Not quite, but about a month and 3 weeks. So this should actually be a reasonably close estimate on what to expect. Not a good sign at all for them to start out fiscal year 2019. Likewise, they expect a net loss of $3.5 to $4.8 million for the quarter. That rounds out to about 8 to 11 cents per share for the first quarter. For the year, they expect same-store sales to be anywhere from a positive 1% to a loss of 2%. Now, this is definitely a fall-off from full-year 1.5% growth in 2018. They do, however, expect earnings per share to rebound a bit on a full-year basis after the first quarter, ending up around 52 to 64 cents per share, and that's compared to 55 cents for the full fiscal year of 2018. Now, interestingly enough, as nicely as the company is doing on the bottom line with these positive earnings per share numbers, their cash flow is still reason for pause here. Cash on hand is just $1.5 million, with $19.3 million of availability on their revolving credit facility. You compare that to $144.3 million outstanding on their credit facility and another $35.6 million outstanding under a term loan. It really causes one to wonder if they'll have the financial ability to expand where and how they want. And speaking of that expansion, the company is overall bullish on what they call market share opportunities in the coming years, suggesting that their segment is fractured currently between the big box stores like Walmart and Target, for example, and even those like Academy that don't focus completely on outdoors. They focus on other sports as well. And Sportsman's Warehouse feels like they have an opportunity to capitalize. And perhaps the most interesting parts of their earnings call actually come from Barker's breakdown on categories. So Barker, the CEO, he actually uses industry comp data in their discussions on the call, which is very helpful. One of their largest market share opportunities that I've identified is firearm sales, because some retailers beginning to balk or second guess their inclusion of firearms and ammo in stores. Some are beginning to walk it back just a little bit. But Sportsman's Warehouse is very clear on their positioning in the category. Firearm unit sales for them saw only a 0.3% increase during the fourth quarter. But, and this is very important, overall NICS data in states holding Sportsman's Warehouse locations showed firearm unit sales overall down 5.1%. So even though it's only an increase of 0.3%, Sportsman's Warehouse very clear about the fact that they feel like this means they're grabbing up market share. They feel like they're growing at a time where others are shrinking back, and allows them an opportunity to cultivate essential repeat customers, because if you sell firearms, chances are good you sell ammo, and those are the types of things that you'll need to have on hand for customers to repurchase going forward. Other categories that Sportsman's Warehouse felt as though they're gaining on the market share front include fishing, which was up 4.5% year over year, and camping at 7.5% gains year over year. As a nice bonus as well for them, footwear was up 9.2% as they begin to make stronger forays into the category. And we talked about footwear to kind of lead off the show, but one thing that's been kind of forgotten, and one kind of footwear segment that's forgotten by a lot of the major players in the space, is the outdoors and activewear footwear segment. Now, it's one thing to sell running shoes or active shoes or dress shoes or what have you, but there are relatively few retailers out there that will sell things like trail running shoes or, you know, things like hiking boots, that type of thing. And so you see Sportsman's Warehouse competing against others in the space. And even if you look to off-price, someone like Sierra Trading Post, but there really isn't a retailer that stuck their neck out and differentiated themselves in that particular footwear category. And I think that's one thing Sportsman's Warehouse trying to do going forward.
They also feel market share opportunities exist in building out their private label selections, something Bass Pro in particular has been good at doing in the past. Although a small increase, private label sales for the company were up 5% as a percentage of overall sales from 4.3% last year. I say up, I mean up to 5% of total sales. And you see that that number for a lot of retailers is especially increasing, but one number that we don't talk about is private label sales as a percentage of sales in this type of retail environment or this type of retail sector. Rather than using the private label to offer less expensive versions of existing products, their private label is actually largely used for exclusive products. Again, similar to Bass Pro's strategy. If you're asking about market share growth as it pertains to brick and mortar, well, they've tapered back their plans just a little bit. For a time, they were experiencing growth far more befitting their own high growth label. However, this fiscal year, they've pared down expected store openings to just 3. Might have something to do with that fact that increasingly tight cash position they have and their need to play catch up in e-commerce, including anticipated spend of around $1 million just in database tools. They actually eliminated plans for a 4-store opening in 2019, not a good sign for the company. All of their stores push their footprint further east in Tennessee, Michigan, and Indiana. However, they are testing a smaller store format, focusing on hunting and shooting to attempt to make good on the white space they see in those categories. In conclusion, they still are a high growth company, is the question? No, they are not. It is a strong underlying concept, but eventually there is a limit on all of the white space the company claims to see, especially as retailers like Big Five, Academy Sports, and so forth continue to expand outdoor selections, especially throughout the Midwest, if you've been paying close attention to those key markets. Additionally, there is a little bit of a concern that one of their strongest categories in firearms must conform to any potential government regulations in the future. And unlike with alcohol, firearm regulations aren't undergoing a significant loosening retail-wise. So, after their earnings call last week, shares plummeted from around $5.43 at close Wednesday to a low of around $4.63 on Thursday. Currently, at recording, they closed Monday did shares around $4.85. Market cap for the company is still around $208 million, which is more or less in line with, again, what our expectations are for the company given the current landscape. And Trent, this is a company that, while it's probably going to be around for a significant portion of time in the future, is definitely one that has competition from a number of sides, a company that we'll be keeping close eyes on as they try to bolster their brand in the eyes of their core customer.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
We've reached the final segment of the Retail Focus podcast, a segment we call Looking Ahead, where each Leighton and I talk about a story we're keeping an eye on for the next week or month or potentially even year or longer. I'll start this week and I go back to Utah, where Sportsman's Warehouse was, of course, based in our last story. Let's talk about beer in Utah more specifically, as a bill was signed into effect last week that basically put Utah's 3.2% alcohol by weight beer law to bed, or it'll put it to bed as of November 1st. But here's the reason we're talking about it. You know, we've talked about a number of states kind of getting rid of these 3.2 beer laws, Kansas and Colorado among the most recent. So you have a number of these states throughout the Midwest that are doing away with it. Well, Utah did away with it, but increased the cap from 3.2% to 4% alcohol by weight. And you wonder, why even bother? Well, I'll tell you why you bother. It's because a lot of beer manufacturers have to make special 3.2 beer versions to sell in grocery stores in these states, Utah being one of the last states to have that beer law. But you wonder, where did that 4% alcohol by weight note come in? Well, guess what? You look at a lot of the macro beers out there, Budweiser, Bud Light, Coors, Coors Light, and so forth. Their regular alcohol by volume is 5%. And when you convert 4% alcohol by weight, what do you get? 5% alcohol by volume. So ultimately, this is a play more towards the macro beers to be able to sell themselves in supermarkets. You're not going to see a big push outside of maybe a few wheat beers and a few lighter pale ales and maybe some session IPAs in terms of craft beer in stores. And some of the businesses will have to, of course, reformulate recipes. By businesses, I mean the breweries that sell in those stores. But overall, this seems like kind of an odd move and not really one that benefits grocery stores all that much. You feel like grocery stores kind of lost out in this particular regulation, whereas in states like Colorado, they get more or less full rein now to sell full alcohol beer in stores. In Kansas, they have a 6% alcohol by volume limit, so higher limit that makes a little bit more sense. So it's kind of interesting that you see Utah sign this beer into legislation, and you wonder if the big macro breweries, if folks like InBev, for example, certainly had a say on where they were putting that cutoff ultimately. And again, I think this is a weird bill that doesn't really benefit grocery stores all that much, doesn't benefit liquor stores all that much, and it increases the tax per barrel on beer in the state. So you kind of wonder why they even bothered to do so. This is kind of like one of those compromises where everyone leaves the table unhappy, and for whatever slight benefit grocery stores might get, it's certainly probably not enough to pay the MAC for all of the extensive lobbying that was likely done to include full-strength beer in grocery stores. And by the way, just in case you're wondering, Utah does have a number of fairly significant chains, but perhaps the most significant grocery chain there, other than, of course, the usual suspects like Walmart and Target, the larger general merchandise retailers that carry groceries as well, is Smith's, which is an offshoot of Kroger. Of course, a number of other local chains as well.
Well, my looking ahead has to do with a city in Massachusetts called Natick, a city that we haven't actually talked about. Reason being, not much going on there except a mall. Looks like Wayfair is going to be joining the mall space with a 3,700 square foot space. Company plans to unveil and reveal a little bit more details about staffing and how the store is going to look a little bit later, but this is actually going to be the first of its kind, considering Wayfair is predominantly an online player in the furniture space, where they do specialty sourcing for a number of different furniture variations and also have some key merchandising aspects that a lot of other retailers online are picking up on. However, this store looks to be not the first in terms of overall brick and mortar trying out, in that they've had pop-up shops earlier in 2018, and they actually have an outlet store in one of their warehouses. So a little bit interesting there, but this is, like I said, going to be the first of its kind, and it's going to coincide with a number more of pop-up shops, around four more pop-up shops for 2019. And the company, while this is a modest foray into brick and mortar, is pretty optimistic about what they feel they can generate in terms of traffic and all of that visibility. It really does bring to light some of the ideas that it's not just about omnichannel here. It's not just about customers buying online and coming to the store to check out the stores. It can also go the other way around. And this is exactly what it would be doing because Wayfair Incorporated, again, a publicly traded company, has started off online. And while they aren't really that profitable, they are making major headway in terms of the market share where they dabble. And I think this is important to note. Massachusetts is sort of a hub for this type of thing. They have a lot of pop-up shops that are predominantly in the news, in the retail news, in the landscape in which we survey different goings on. And I think this is interesting because Natick, Massachusetts does have a pretty nice mall that gets a lot of media coverage. So maybe this was more strategic because if you think about that square footage, 3,700 square feet, while that is a pretty big store, it's nothing like a typical furniture store where you could see them go up to 30 or 40,000 square feet, or maybe even an IKEA, which is a little bit both furniture and home design, if you will. But other than that, I am looking forward to see if this is going to be popular, if this is going to be successful, or if this is more of something you would see in Manhattan, where the rates are far too much to justify an actual retail location. But you see a lot of stores doing it mostly just for the advertising and being there in front of the millions of customers who walk by. And while the Natick, Massachusetts Mall isn't that popular, it certainly is a good place to start.
Well, that'll do it for us here on the Retail Focus podcast. For Leighton, I'm Trent. I appreciate Leighton saying there wasn't much going on in Natick, Massachusetts, and now welcome all the mail from the Natick residents reaching out to us. But in any case, you can reach out to us on Twitter and Instagram at Retail Podcast. And once again, we'll be back a week from now.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.